everyone. Welcome to the first internet episode of Solitaire Rose Radio. Why do I say internet episode? Well, back a gajillion years ago when I was in college, I had a radio show on the campus AM station, and I was feeling a little full of myself. Wanted to sound like a real honest-to-God radio professional, and I knew that most of them didn't use their real names. So I used my internet name, and believe it or not, I had an internet name. It was back before there was a World Wide Web, but I had an email address, and I wanted to use the internet name of Hunter Rose, seeing as how he was my favorite comic book character. So I logged on to the campus internet. I said, please choose your email address. I put in Hunter Rose, and it was taken. And I figured, well, I have a dorm room all to myself. I'm not dating anybody. Oh, Solitaire Rose sounds cool. So I went with that. I've used the name ever since, both on the internet and other places, but for purposes of this, when it was time for me to come up with a name for the radio show, I called myself Solitaire Rose and went with the Solitaire Rose Radio name. For the first year, it was kind of a standard. I was on, I think it was Monday nights, in the evening, and I had a couple of friends who also were on the station who'd sit in, and we'd chat a little bit between records, but mostly we played records. But the thing was, the chatting in between records was where we started getting phone calls, and this was a ratty little AM station. If you got a phone call once an hour that wasn't, "Could you please play the song that's number one on the charts this week?" It was shocking. We would have people call in, you know, two or three an hour saying, "When you guys were talking about this, I found it really interesting." So the next, there was summer break, and when we came back, they said, "Do you want to have a show again?" And I said, "Yeah, but I want a different format. I don't want to have to play records so much. Want to do more where we're talking about stuff." And they said, "Well, you know, you got some phone calls. You're doing it really late when nobody listens anyway." So we had kind of a really interesting radio format. It was myself and whichever one of my friends were around. Usually it was two or three of my friends, one of which has passed. And we would spend the week coming up with ideas for what we'd talk about to fill the 3 hours. And it was a lot of fun. But I also realized doing that I didn't want to do radio full time, because I talked to people who worked in radio and they talked about the low pay, they talked about how you had to move a lot, they talked about how the hours suck, how you had to have two or three outside jobs to make a living. So now we got this here podcast. Now, for those of you who are fans of crazy comics and stories, this is kind of a side project. Joe won't be on the show. Well, he might be on once in a while. But this is a very different format. This is an idea I came up with last year. I've talked about it on Crazy. We'll get into it as we go. I'll explain a little bit, do some housekeeping. And the housekeeping is that this is going to show up on the Crazy feed, but it'll be called Solitaire Rose Radio. So if you don't like it, you can delete it and make me cry. And the reason I'm doing that is there are a number of podcasts I like. And one of them is Comic Geek Speak. And they have side projects that show up once in a blue moon. And at the beginning, they had them all in the main feed. And then as time went on, they split them off into their separate feeds. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that I had to subscribe to this feed and that feed and the other feed. I just wanted it all to be part of Comic Geek Speak, and then there was a point where they counted them all up and they added the number of those, of some of the side podcasts to the main. But so that's one reason. The other reason is Crazy Comics and Stories has built up kind of a following. We've got a large number of people who download each episode. And rather than start up a new one and have to rebuild an audience, no, I'm just going to feed off the audience that Joe and I have created, since I'm the one who does all the recording and does all the editing and runs the website, and Joe just kind of calls in. So that's why this is part of your crazy feed. The idea behind this podcast is something that came together out of a number of different things. First is, Joe is constantly telling me about how you've got all this comic book knowledge locked away in your head, and I wish, you know, there's got to be some way to get it all out. But the other one is, I've been listening to a lot of podcasts. I've been listening to WTF with Mark Maron, where he interviews comedians and entertainers and stuff. I've been listening to The Art of Wrestling with Colt Cabana, where he sits down and talks to wrestlers and they tell stories about what it's like on the road, what it's like to be in that business. And I've been listening to Smodcast, the Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, and Fat Man on Batman. I've always been a big fan of This American Life on NPR. And it's all about stories. All of the podcasts I enjoy are people telling their story, or telling stories about their life, or stories about what they do. And I think everyone has a story. Everyone's story is interesting. Everyone's life is interesting. And since I've got all this knowledge about comic book history, I want to tell the stories about comic book history. There are going to be interviews on the podcast from time to time, but it's not going to be where here's a Joe Brony who's coming out with his new comic on Kickstarter and he's looking to do a bunch of interviews to advertise it. It'll be more where I might talk to some comic creators, I might talk to some people who are involved in the periphery of comics, some people who work in comics retail, some people who just collect comics, getting at their story about why they read comics, what they look for in comics, what sort of stories they have. And it's starting to sound like that this will be all comics. I don't know where it's going to go. I've got ideas for about the first 6 months worth, but who knows where it'll go from there. So it's kind of an ongoing experiment. There'll be some interesting stuff. There was also an email exchange I had with Peter Rios, who used to be on Comic Geek Speak, and now he does the Daily Rios. And I did it because I wanted to get into sort of put myself in the mindset of how we all see the world differently, how fandom makes us different, how our interests seem very different to people. Joe and I have talked in the past. I am a huge fan of ECW. ECW was a small wrestling promotion that briefly became the number three promotion in professional wrestling before they just ran out of money. But to Joe and myself and other people around here, the stuff that ECW did was legendary. It was huge. There are things that happened that are so big in our minds because we watched this on TV and we enjoyed it. We wanted more information. There's, in Philadelphia, the ECW Arena. It was talked about as if it was this holy mecca of wrestling. Well, by ECW, by WWF and WCW, they called it a bingo hall, which it was. But it seemed like everything that was happening there was huge. They would film there, and the place was packed, and they talked about how important it was. And so Peter Rios lives in the Philadelphia area. And I know he's not a wrestling fan, but he's involved, he's plugged into the pop culture of the area. So I emailed him and I asked, did you ever hear of ECW? You know, the building, do you know about the building? I've heard that it was in a bad neighborhood. They talked about Tony Lukes. They even had a character in ECW, Tony Mama Luke, who was kind of a tribute to the restaurant Tony Lukes. And he said, you know, I never heard of it. I know that that's not the best part of town. Tony Lukes is great. But anything that to Joe and I and some other wrestling fans that I know who this is huge. He lived in the area and he didn't know about it. Didn't know anything about it. And it's, I know it sounds a little weird, but that's what got me thinking about doing this. There's stuff that all of us know that to us is big and important and huge, but to other people, they know nothing about it. When I listened to the WTF with Mark Maron episode where he interviewed Colt Cabana, Colt Cabana is a wrestler. He does a podcast. His podcast, he says right from the onstart, is an imitation of WTF. He finally gets on with Mark Maron. And Mark Maron talks about how he knows nothing about professional wrestling. Nothing. And it's not he went into it going, oh, well, you know, it's fake and these guys are this. He went into it with curiosity. Wanting to know. I want to know what it's like. And he learned that the life of a indie professional wrestler is very much like the life of a mid-level comic where, you know, you're trying to book gigs. You get to town and you hope you're getting paid. And you perform in front of people and you hope there's a big audience. And you try to build up a name so that it's no longer, I go here because it's Tom's Chuckle Hut. Oh, I'm going here because it's Mark Maron. And that's what made me think there are all these stories. And I want to bring that curiosity. When I say I'm going to look into a topic, I'm going to try and dig in and dig the stories out. Will it work? Well, we'll see. I really want feedback on this episode. I want feedback on all the episodes, actually. But I'd really like some feedback on this. So I have created a Facebook page for Solitaire Rose Radio, and that link will be in the description. You can also email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. And we are also looking for advertisers, so if you want to advertise, email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. We do have an advertiser, and that advertiser is dreamhost.com. That's right. Same one as Crazy Comics and Stories. Dreamhost.com is the web host that I use. And over on Crazy, we have a lot of fun talking about it. But as on here, since this podcast is a little more serious, I'll be a little more serious. I don't know much about putting websites together, believe it or not. I started a website in 99. I actually had someone build it for me, and then she showed me how to update it. I've had blogs. The podcast is on a blog, and it was very much a, okay, I need to take this weekend, shut the door, turn off the TV, and figure out how to do this. Dreamhost.com is the website I use. They're very reasonably priced. The longer I've been with them, the more I've liked them, because as time has gone on, web traffic goes up. As web traffic goes up, they haven't raised my rates. As more and more storage is needed for things like podcasts and video podcasts and things like that, they haven't raised my rates. Email, they have a wonderful email system, and they give great customer service. So if you go to dreamhost.com and you want to set up a web page, put in the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year, which brings it under $100 to set up a website. And you can use the website for anything. So it's dreamhost.com. The problem with the first episode of a podcast is you have to set up what you're doing, which I did. Hopefully that describes it well enough that you're interested. But the other thing is, well, what do you do? Do you dive right in? Do you have an introductory episode? Do you do a pilot episode? And one of the reasons it's taken so long for me to start up Solitaire Rose Radio, other than the fact that pretty much since September, I've been working a lot of overtime, a frightening amount of overtime. So the time I have off, I've pretty much been catching up on my sleep, is that I didn't quite know how to start the show. Well, a couple of weeks ago I did. I was a customer for a long time of Discount Comic Book Service, and while they have not bought an ad, I really like them. And if you're looking to buy comic books, they're a wonderfully cheap way to go. You order the stuff, you get 30 to 40% off everything. They have special deals. And here's what I love the best. They send it to you. So you get box day. Well, with my employment changing, I wasn't able to afford to buy comics from DBCS, so there was no box day for a while. I know, sad. And after, I would say, sometime in October, I emailed them and said, yeah, my job hunt isn't going as well as I'd like. Why don't you go ahead, close out my account, send me what's left. So, since I hadn't ordered anything in a while, all that was really left in my account were books and trade paperbacks and comics that were late, and they closed out the account, sent me a box. I got it a week before Christmas. It was my Christmas present, and it was free because I'd paid for it months and months and months ago. So I thought what I would do is go through the list of what I got, give a little background, a little history on each thing. Not going to recommend it because most of it I haven't read yet. I've been working too much overtime. But I thought it'd be interesting, and maybe you could see what sort of stories I'm going to tell. All right, first on the list is Red Sonja number 60. Yes, I like Red Sonja. I'm a fan of Robert E. Howard. The reason this was on the list, any comic book that's on the list is because it was 2 to 3 months late. Because they sent me my last box in December, because that was when all the comics you order in October, they show up in December. I got my last box in December of 2011, and anything that's not in there is going to be late. And boy, there were a lot of late books. So, Red Sonja was actually a character from Robert E. Howard that Roy Thomas made into a star, because Red Sonja wasn't a major character in the Conan stories. It was kind of a throwaway supporting character. Roy Thomas gave her more of a background, fleshed the character out, and in the mid-70s, when everything Conan was selling really well for Marvel, they gave her a spinoff that was drawn by Frank Thorne, of all people. Underground artist Frank Thorne working at Marvel. And Roy Thomas, when Marvel lost the rights to the Robert E. Howard stuff, Dark Horse picked up Conan, Cull, Solomon Kane, the other characters, but Red Sonja was picked up by a company called Dynamite. And they have really run that book into the ground. They've got a Red Sonja book. They have a Queen Sonja book. They've reprinted all the Marvel stuff. The character's been around for quite a while in comics, so a lot of the stuff around the character, her origin, things like that, have become cliches. But at the time, in comics, it was a very innovative character. Dynamite has done an okay job with the character. There are times they bring in really good talent, like Oming and I can't think off the top of my head, but they've brought in some really good talent at times. Now the book's just kind of cruising. Well, I don't read it anymore, but at the time, the book was just kind of cruising on reputation and name. Next on the list was Showcase Presents Batman Volume 5. Showcase Presents is DC's answer to the Essential Volumes. Quite honestly, I like the Essential Volumes better than the Showcase, simply because Silver Age Marvel was more interesting and more of a soap opera, so it reads better in big chunks, whereas DC at the time was, the editors knew they were aiming their stories at kids. They would stick to one-issue stories where it would be a gimmick. There would be a gimmick of some kind. The villain's got this weird power. Will the superhero figure it out and learn the way to counteract the power and defeat the villain? Whereas Marvel, it was very much more, you had the romantic subplots, you had the hero constantly struggling against their internal issues, and you had the Kirby fight scenes. Even the books Kirby didn't draw were influenced by Kirby, where you'd have these long fight scenes of, you know, lots of battle and action. In Showcase Volume 5, this is right after the Batman TV series ended. Now, during the Batman TV series, well, let's go back a little further. By the early 60s, Batman was selling horribly. So they were doing goofy stories of time travel and, you know, Batman being hypnotized and going to other planets, and it was kind of a bad second generation of the Superman stuff that was being done at the time. Sales were in the toilet. They were about to cancel the book. Instead, they gave it to Julie Schwartz, who brought in a lot of the people he'd used for the superhero revival on Flash and Green Lantern and Justice League. That was called the New Look Batman. And that started in 64. And the stories took a nice step up. They were still very gimmicky stories, but it was more detective gimmick. The Julie Schwartz, you know, figure out what the gimmick is and the hero has solved the crime. After the Batman, when the Batman TV show hit, Batman sales went through the roof, and DC very wisely said, hey, if we're going to do a Batman comic with the Batman TV show on, we need to have the Joker, we need to have the Riddler, we need to have Catwoman, we need to have... So it became very much like the TV show, and the TV show was very much like the 50s comic, except they added supervillains. After the TV show ended, sales went down fast. While the TV show was big, Batman sold between 800,000 and 1 million copies, which is more than it had ever sold. Even in the 40s, it didn't sell that well. But after the TV show ended, a huge collapse in sales. Julie Schwartz, who was still the editor, wanted to combat that, so he changed direction again. He brought in new writers, new artists. A lot of the Denny O'Neil, Neil Adams stuff was around this time. Denny O'Neil and Neil Adams had worked together on some other books. And Neil Adams was kind of the hot artist at the time. If you look at a lot of DC Comics in the late 60s, you'll see Neil Adams covers. Because they learned real quick, Neil Adams cover sells better than a cover by other artists. The other thing about the Batman book at the time, they decided to jump on the gothic horror trend. So there is a lot of spooky dark mansions and dark histories of characters and things that seem like horror. A lot of ghosts. A lot of ghosts. Oh my God, so many ghosts. So this trade paperback reprints a lot of that. I've read most of the Neil Adams stuff, but the other stuff is going to be new. I know that at this time they closed the Batcave and the Wayne Manor, moved into Wayne Tower. They really focused on Bruce Wayne as a, you know, jet-setting business guy who by night he was Batman, and during the day he set up foundations to help victims of crime. They sent Robin off to school. They spun Batgirl off into her own backup series, which was seen very infrequently. So, that's the history behind that. Next on the list was Marvel Masterwork, Golden Age USA Comics, Hardcover Volume 2. I enjoy Golden Age books, but when you read Golden Age, you have to remember they were done in the 40s. So, I opened up the book and, oh, the racism is just right in your face. The Japanese have the round face and the buck teeth, and the skin is jaundice yellow, and they talk in pidgin English. And this is during World War II, and one of the things about Marvel was that they really jumped on the anti-Axis bandwagon. USA Comics, it's weird that they didn't bring Captain America in with the first issue. It was an anthology, so you've got Captain America and a number of others. This was kind of the second tier. The first tier was at Marvel in the Golden Age was Marvel Mystery Comics. That was their top line book. There was Submariner and Human Torch, who spun out of Marvel Mystery Comics, and Captain America. Captain America was, I would have to triple check, but I'm pretty sure that Captain America, when Simon and Kirby were doing it, was their number one book by far. After Simon and Kirby left, Captain America took kind of a step down, and Marvel Mystery was selling better. But that's because they would have Human Torch, Submariner, Captain America on the covers. They had these beautiful Alex Schoenberg covers, too. So USA Comics had some stories of Captain America. They were a second-tier book. I know very little about these characters in these stories, so I'm looking forward to reading it. The other thing about the Marvel Masterworks is they've pretty much gone through and reprinted all the Silver Age stuff. They've reprinted the big guns of the Bronze Age stuff, and now they're going for the secondary tier. I enjoy the Atlas reprints. That's the reprints of Marvel stuff from the 50s, because it's a lot of short stories. You get a lot of, well, the art is uneven. You'll get early Gil Kane. You'll get early Steve Ditko. You'll get all this wonderful Joe Manganiello art. You'll get Kirby art. And then you'll get art that's just plain horrible by people I'm not going to name. But that was the horror anthologies and the monster anthologies. And they've even reprinted some of the Western stuff. I don't think they'll ever do a Millie the Model or Tilly the Typer masterwork or Homer the Happy Ghost. Those were all the humor books that Marvel put out. But the masterworks are these expensive volumes that do high quality reprints of the stuff. And one of the reasons it is so high dollar is because it's a very specialized market. There aren't a lot of people who are going to say, hey, look, it's issues 5 through 8 of USA Comics from 1942 and 43. Gotta have that. So they sell around 2,000 copies. And because the reproduction costs are so much, and the market's going to be small, they put it in this really nice format so they could justify charging $50, $60, $70 for it. If you're not already a huge fan of the Golden Age stuff, you probably aren't even going to be interested in it. A good book to pick up to see Marvel's Golden Age, they've got reprints of the Captain America stuff by Simon and Kirby. And Marvel Mystery Comics, I think they've done a reprint in paperback of the first four issues. They also keep saying they're going to put out an essential of Marvel Mystery Comics, but they never have. I'll talk more about that sort of thing in future episodes. But with the real quality reprints, my appreciation for what Marvel was doing back then has skyrocketed, because before then, the reprints have always been very muddy, and I've read the Golden Age stuff, and it seems very crude and hard to read, and some of it is very, very crude, but some of it, the art is head and shoulders above what the earlier reproductions looked like. Let's see, what's next on the list? Back issue number 53. Back issue and alter ego. If you want to well, anything by Tomorrow's, if you want to know comic history, those guys have it down. Back issue is more Bronze Age, although they do get into Silver Age from time to time. Alter Ego is Golden Age and Silver Age. A lot of interviews with some big-name talents, some lesser-known talents, some people who were in and out of the comic field. Jack Kirby, the Jack Kirby magazine, I think it's called Jack Kirby Quarterly, is by far my favorite magazine. It's tabloid size because they reprint his art at the size it was drawn. It's articles and interviews and discussion about Jack Kirby, who, when it comes to comics, I think Jack Kirby. Stan Lee called him Jack King Kirby, and there's a reason why. And we'll get into that more later. Back issue 53, really am a huge fan of back issue, and think that if you want to know comics history, you read that. There's just no substitute for the Tomorrow stuff. DC Comics presents Elseworlds 80-page giant. This is a reprint of a book that was never released in the U.S. What it was, there was in the late 90s, well, through the 90s, DC was doing books called Elseworlds, which was their version of What If. Except Marvel's What If was you take a certain point in time and change something. Like, well, the first issue of What If in 77 was What If Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? And if you think, wow, that's kind of goofy, in the first issue of Spider-Man, he snuck into the Fantastic Four's building because he wanted a job. And they said, oh, we don't pay people. All our money goes to foundations. Well, what if Reed Richards said, well, you know, we could use some help. Maybe we'll figure out a way to give you a salary. And the story went from there. Or my favorite issue of What If ever. What if Elektra hadn't been killed? And here's a spoiler alert. It was the Frank Miller Daredevil story where you get to issue 181. Bullseye kills Elektra. And Daredevil then goes to exact revenge. Well, what if Bullseye hadn't killed Elektra? Guess what? They both give up their secret identities and go to live happy ever after on an island in Greece. And I thought that was a great what if. It's, yeah, you know what? Here's what would happen. Or, I really wish there was a what if the Phoenix hadn't been killed and it was, oh, she destroys the universe. I would have liked it better if they would have went with Chris Claremont's plot, because when Chris Claremont was plotting the X-Men, Phoenix wasn't killed. That was added later when Jim Shooter saw the issues leading up to it and went, well, she needs to be punished. She killed a whole planet of people. We can't let her just be, she's good now. So the solution they came up with was Jean Grey dies. Well, Claremont had plotted all the way up to issue 150, and it's been talked about in different books and different interviews of him. I really wish that issue of What If would have done that, and I'm digressing, which I will do on this podcast. So the Elseworlds was DC's version, and it was more, well, what if there was a Batman in the Victorian era? What if Superman was Robin Hood? What if Superman was around when the Martians invaded during H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds? They did a 80-page giant, because they were doing 80-page giants toward the end of the 90s. And these were just little short stories of little bitty Elseworlds. And one of them was Kyle Baker's Superman's Babysitter. And it's a story of Clark Kent as a baby. His parents go out and they leave baby Superman with the babysitter and mischief ensues. Well, there's one scene where he gets in the microwave and the microwave's turned on and nothing happens to him because he's Superman. Well, Super Baby. although not the Super Baby of the 60s, which annoys me, and I hate all those stories. And Paul Levitz, when he saw it after it was printed and approved, Paul Levitz was the editor-in-chief of DC, although that's not what they called him at DC. He saw it and went, oh, we can't have this, and he had all the copies destroyed. Except the ones that were going to England were already shipped and ready to go to stores because they have to ship stuff early for it to get to England on time. So the only way to get this book was to go out on eBay and buy it off somebody who bought it over in England. Well, they reprinted it, and I'm really looking forward to it. Now, a lot of the stories have seen print elsewhere in the hardcover Bizarro Comics and some other things, but I'm really looking forward to reading this book. Steve Ditko Omnibus, Volume 2. The Steve Ditko Omnibus, this is the stuff Ditko did for DC. In Volume 1, they reprinted The Creeper, which was his 60s series for DC, and a bunch of the short horror stories he did, as well as some one-shots and things like that. This reprints Hawk and Dove, which was the other book he did for DC in the 60s. A bunch of Legion of Superheroes stuff. Yeah, that's right. Steve Ditko, during the late 70s, drew the Legion of Superheroes. He drew fill-in issues of the Legion of Superheroes. Which is weird when you think about it. It's also got some one-shots and short stuff he did. He did a Starman comic that was part of Adventure Comics. It was half Starman by Ditko and half Plastic Man. He did the first issue of Man-Bat. So you get Ditko drawing Batman. I love Steve Ditko's art. I really do. I think that his run on Amazing Spider-Man is one of the cultural touchstones, not just of comics, but of the 60s, because it captured that idea of the neurotic hero, much like Woody Allen did, much like other comedians did. It was in the 50s, you watch a 50s movie, the protagonist is always, you know, the stalwart, upright, heroic, blah, blah, blah. In the 60s, you had more the kind of the schlub, the guy who doubts himself, the guy who puts himself down, the guy who makes fun of himself. Spider-Man brought that in. You also had all these wonderful characters that Ditko created. Spider-Man had the best supporting cast of any comic book ever. His work at DC, Hawk and Dove, was, I haven't read them all, but it's a very simplistic view. Dove likes peace. Hawk likes war. They're brothers. They share their power and they fight crime. So I'm interested to read that. It's also Ditko, just a couple years after his Spider-Man run, so his art was still at its peak. Now, the reason Ditko came to DC and did these books, after he left Marvel, he worked for Warren Publishing for a while, doing stories in Creepy and Eerie, and he also went to Carlton and worked with editor Dick Giordano. Dick Giordano had come into Carlton, and they said, can you please do something to get our books to sell? So he looked around, up, the Marvel superheroes are selling, the DC superheroes are selling, we're going to do some superhero books. Now, when DC's sales started to lag in the late 60s, they brought in Giordano. We need new editors, new ideas, new talent. And he brought a lot of the guys over from Carlton he'd worked with. Usually an editor will want to work with people he's worked with and he could trust. So when Giordano came over to DC, he brought most of his artists and writers, one of which was Ditko. Ditko was there for a couple of years, but Ditko tends to, he doesn't stay with companies very long. Trying to think of the nicest way to put this. Ditko has a set of ethics that he does not bend on. And a lot of it is based on Ayn Rand's objectivism. he won't draw stories with a protagonist who, he won't draw stories about an anti-hero. And he talks about that in his later work, where there are things he wants in his hero, things he wants in his villain, the type of stories he wants to tell. If he's at a company where he has to tell stories of a different kind, he'll just refuse. He just won't do it. So, Ditko's one of those guys. I disagree with his philosophy vehemently. I find when he writes his own stories, they're not really stories. It's him lecturing the reader and setting up straw man arguments as the villains. But his art is still unbelievably amazing. If you haven't read any Ditko stuff, well, first I would get The Amazing Spider-Man Essentials 1 and 2. But the Ditko omnibuses are really a good read as long as you realize it's Silver Age stuff. So it doesn't fit modern sensibility and modern storytelling. A lot of exposition in the dialogue, a lot of exposition in the dialogue. They didn't do the show don't tell back then. Let's see. Next on my list is the Erie Archives Volume 9. This reprints the Warren magazine Erie, which was, well, it started as a horror magazine. It still had a lot of horror stories, but it also did science fiction stories. Volume 9 reprints stuff from the early 70s. I think it's 71 and 72. This was the beginning of the Warren Renaissance, because what it was, when Warren first started, Archie Goodwin edited their books. He had access to a lot of the best artists at the time. A lot of the guys who worked at EC. I talked about how he had Steve Ditko. He had early Neil Adams. Those things that he edited were some of the best comics ever printed. After he left, the quality took a big step down. And because the magazines weren't selling as well, they packed a lot of reprints into them. Some of the creepy and eerie hardcovers that I've bought that reprint everything, they don't reprint the stuff that's been printed in previous books. You would see entire issues where they just have the cover and the table of contents and a little note. Yeah, this is in Volume 3, this in Volume 2, this in Volume 4, this. By this point, they were only doing one or two reprints an issue. And the stories were on the upswing. They were getting a lot of people at the beginning of their career. You have early stories by Doug Minch, early stories by Don McGregor. You've got a lot of artists who are trying new things. I would not pick these up unless you already know about Creepy and Eerie, because they're $50 books. But the Creepy and the Eerie stuff is really good at this point. So we're back to reprinting the really good stuff. We're about to get into where he hires Louise Jones as a editor, who most comic fans would know now as Louise Simonson. Her run is considered the second golden age, and then after that it's a slow fade. Oh, what do we have next? Atlas Eris Tales to Astonish Masterwork Volume 4. This is the last Tales to Astonish. It reprints the last few pre-hero issues. Tales to Astonish then became the home of Ant-Man. Now, the Ant-Man stories have been reprinted in Marvel Masterworks Ant-Man, which you can also get in the Essential Ant-Man. And, they're not the greatest stories of Marvel's Silver Age. But as they transitioned from the monsters to superheroes, some of the books still had monster stories as backups and horror stories as backups. So this reprints the last few of the monster horror stories. Then when Ant-Man takes over half the book, they just reprint the horror stories and the mystery stories from the back of those books. Again, this is for hardcore fans only. But I enjoy it because you get those wonderful Stan Lee, Steve Ditko horror stories, which were kind of a step above the other horror stuff that Marvel did. And I think Ditko had a huge influence. They're very Twilight Zone-y. They usually have a twist at the end. Usually the twist is telegraphed, but they're kind of a step above the other stuff that Marvel was doing with these sort of stories. And of course, you can't beat a Kirby Monster story. Kirby Monster stories are some of the most fun. There's a reason why Marvel writers keep bringing back the Kirby monsters in the superhero stuff, because these stories are just fun. Kirby had a great design sense. Again, this is for hardcore fans only, but I really am looking forward to this, because most of these are stories I've never read. Let's see, what's next? Powers 8, 9, and 10. Powers is a book that I used to really love, but it's now gotten to the point where the creators are busy on other stuff. So when you read each issue, there's a, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that this book is late. It's been so long since the last one. But hey, we're going to be back on track, and sales will be back on track. And they aren't. I think just within the last year, they relaunched Powers with a new number one. And it said in the letters page how, we're going to be monthly. And there hasn't been an issue since. So I enjoy Powers, but I'm switching to trades on it because, boy, the wait between issues is unbelievably long. And Bendis tells stories in a very cinematic way. So you do want to read them in chunks because they go by very briskly. As you read, you get through it very, very rapidly. There's my copy of Stan Lee and Jack Kirby Wonder Years, which is listed as a trade paperback. You could go to the book, you could go to your comics shop and you can order it, but it is actually a very special issue of Jack Kirby Quarterly. It is a long breakdown of the Fantastic Four issue by issue by a huge Jack Kirby fan. He passed away before it was printed. Tons and tons and tons of information. It is a perfect companion to the Lee Kirby 102 issues of the Fantastic Four. I talked about it on Crazy Comics and Stories. I just love the book, and I'm glad that I finally have my own copy rather than getting it from the library and having to give it back in 3 weeks. If you are a Kirby fan, you have to have this book. If you don't know much about Kirby and you don't know much about the Fantastic Four, this is a good starting point. Pick up the Fantastic Four Essentials, read them along with this book, and you will become a Kirby historian. You will understand why he is so well regarded, but you'll also get a deeper understanding of what was going on when these books were being printed. See, I'm looking at more issues of Red Sonja, more issues of Powers. Crazy and Ignatz, trade paperback 1922 to 1924, A Dream of Love. Crazy and Ignatz is the name of the Fantagraphic reprint of the comic strip Crazy Cat. Crazy Cat was a comic strip by George Harriman. It is considered a masterpiece. I completely agree. It's a wonderful work of surrealism. It's a very simple story. There's a cat, Crazy Cat. We don't know if Crazy Cat is male or female. There is a mouse, Ignatz, who Crazy Cat seems to be in love with, and Ignatz is either in love with or annoyed by Crazy Cat, and it primarily attacks by throwing bricks. There is also Officer Pup, who is a dog, who is always arresting Ignatz, putting him in jail. It's hard to describe because even as I'm saying it, wow, that sounds really stupid. It's a very simple strip, but the art, George Harriman was constantly experimenting and playing with the art of what could be a comic strip, and it was the The stuff they're reprinting was the Sunday strips, which took up an entire newspaper page. And it's this beautiful work of surrealism and minimalism and storytelling and playing with the art style. And the figures are very simple, but the stories, you know, the stories have this simple framework, but there's a complexity to it and a beauty to it. The strip was not very popular at all, but it was in all the William Randolph Hearst papers because it was William Randolph Hearst's favorite comic strip. And he was rich, he owned the paper, so it ran. Fantagraphics has now reprinted all the Sundays. I have all of the books that reprint the Sundays. It's not something you could sit down and read straight through. You read a few, you put it down, you read a few later. It's a comic strip that ran from the 20s to the 40s. But it's not based on cultural references. It's really a very timeless comic strip. So as you read it, once you get into the rhythm of it and the way he uses dialect and dialogue, you'll forget that this is a comic strip that's almost 90 years old. If you're interested in the book, I would pick up the later volumes and see if it appeals to you. They're oversized. Fantagraphics has done a wonderful job with the packaging, and even if you're not really a comic book person or a comic strip person, if you're an art person, this shows what was kind of going on in the experimental end of line art at the time. Because Harriman was thought of more as a fine artist than a guy who drew comics. We're getting near the end of the list, and everybody shouts, hooray! Fighting American trade paperback. These reprint the Simon and Kirby 50s comic Fighting American. There was a brief superhero resurgence in the 50s. Like 51, 52, superheroes came back for a short time. Simon and Kirby had created Captain America for Timely. Then after the war, they went to DC, and then after they were at DC, they were sort of freelance. They had their own publishing company for a short time, and they wanted to recreate the success of Captain America, so they came out with Fighting American. However, they really couldn't pull off the gung-ho, we're going to fight the commies, the way they did for the Nazis. So Fighting American kind of went camp. Not wholeheartedly camp like the Batman TV show, but more, you know, they had villains like Hotsy Trotsy, who, you know, just kind of goofy villains. The heroes were playing it straight. Kirby's art is, it's better than his Golden Age stuff, and his Golden Age stuff was really good. By the 50s, he was just a master of the form. And even though the stories are a bit goofy, the art is, I'll just read it for the Kirby art. It's a trade paperback. It's been reprinted a few times in hardcover. But this one, Joe Simon printed a trade paperback on his own. Let's see. Judge Dredd, Mega City Masters, and Death Lives. These are two reprints of British comics featuring Judge Dredd, who is probably the longest running solo character in England. He's still going in the comic 2000 AD. The premise of Judge Dredd is very simple. It's a couple of hundred years in the future. Humanity has pretty much wiped out most of the U.S. except for the Eastern Seaboard, which is Mega City 1, which is a city that goes all the way from Maine to Florida. They don't have cops in the future, they have judges. Why are they judges? Because they fulfill the role of a cop, they're going out to stop crime, but they also pass sentence right there. It's action, it's satire, it's very British, and I've always enjoyed Judge Dredd. The thing about Judge Dredd that they've learned is Dredd himself is not an interesting character. Dredd is, I am the law. And no, the horrible Stallone movie in the 90s does not do the book justice. It's kind of like looking at the Dolph Lundgren Punisher movie and saying, oh, well, that's what the Punisher's like. Death Lives reprints all of these stories featuring Judge Death, which is an extra-dimensional judge from an Earth where life is a crime. And he's kind of Judge Dredd's Dr. Doom or Judge Dredd's Green Goblin. He's the big villain. And whenever he comes back, Judge Dredd fans are like, oh, this is going to be a special story. Mega City Masters reprints random stories by some of the best artists who've worked on Judge Dredd. Guys like Alan Davis, Brian Boland, Ian Gibson. Really good stuff. Good in small doses. I don't think I could sit down and read. Well, I've got some of the stuff that reprints every Judge Dredd story, and I've found that you can read two or three stories, or if it's a long continued story, you can read that. But if you read it back to back to back to back, there is a sameness to it. It's come to the U.S. a few times in the early 80s. Eagle reprinted it, and the first few issues were a big hit, but then as sales dropped, the reproduction wasn't as good. So sales would drop, the reproduction wouldn't look as good, which would cause the sales to drop, so the reproduction wouldn't be as good, and on and on and on. There have been a couple attempts to do Judge Dredd in the U.S. DC did one where they gave Judge Dredd this stupid origin that didn't fit the character at all, and I think it might have worked if people didn't know who Judge Dredd already was. DC had licensed the character to use, but people had already read Judge Dredd stories, so adding this convoluted background and giving him a superhero type origin, yeah, people just didn't read it. Canceled. IDW is doing a version now. There are two issues out. I'm iffy on it because it feels like they're trying to Americanize it again. And what they should do is just reprint the British stuff because 2000 AD's had like 1,800 issues. They're a weekly. Just reprint that stuff. There's enough of it out there. Don't try and do it again. Dredd doesn't need a revamp. But this is the British stuff. This is the hardcore stuff. Two books left. Creepy Archives Volume 4. These are the last few issues of Creepy that were edited by Archie Goodwin. I'm looking forward to this stuff because the thing about when Archie Goodwin was editing at Warren, he also wrote most of the stories. He was a huge EC fan. So he tries very hard to capture that feeling that EC had in their horror books. Not just the twist ending, but getting the best artists and trying to tell stories that are a step above what's being out there. After Goodwin left, the books took a huge, huge tumble in quality. But this is the last few issues by Archie Goodwin. Haven't read them. Looking forward to it. The last book is John Byrne's Complete New Next Men. More history on that. Next Men was, in the early 90s, everybody, after Image, everybody went out and said, we are going to do creator-owned superheroes. And Dark Horse lined up a bunch of people they called Legend. You had Frank Miller didn't do superheroes. He did Sin City, which you know you may have heard of. Hellboy was done by Mike Mignola. Art Adams did a book, Monkey Man and O'Brien, that I think he was able to put out like 3 issues in 5 years. And Byrne did a book called Next Men. The history of Next Men. When Byrne was back at Marvel after Jim Shooter left, he worked with Stan Lee on creating a line of futuristic superheroes. And Stan gave him ideas, and he went away, and he drew this graphic novel. And by the time he came back with it, Stan was really no longer in... I don't want to say he wasn't in good graces, but Stan was a lot of, there, Stan. Yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't you go back to Hollywood and keep doing what you do? And Marvel was lining up the 2099 line. And Byrne's graphic novel was supposed to be the kickoff of it, but Marvel decided to go a different direction. So when the creator-owned stuff exploded and Byrne was asked to join the Legend line, he just brought that trade paperback over, reworked it, named it 2112. Gosh, I wonder where he got that from. And that was kind of the jumping off point for his Next Men series, which was his version of superheroes in the real world. The reason I've picked up volumes 1 and 2 was I remember at the time thinking, oh, this is a decent premise. And Byrne was still doing stories that I wanted to read, but the bloom was off the rose for Byrne for me, because he had left Superman mid-story because somebody at DC pissed him off. Then he went over to Marvel, and there were like 4 or 5 books that he left mid-story. And the one that still irks me is he did a story where he didn't like the fact that Vision had emotions and got married and had kids. And he said, no, in the Vision's origin, he's a robot. So we need to, him having emotions and everything, it's against how the character was created. Even though the second story of the Vision by Roy Thomas was called Even an Android Can Cry. And the end of the story was Vision has been accepted into the Avengers. He goes into the other room and a single tear goes down his cheek. So the whole, he's an emotionless robot. It's something Byrne created in his own head. Kind of like when he said, oh, I don't like the Spider-Man marriage because Mary Jane is a supermodel. And if you read Spider-Man at the time, Mary Jane was doing lingerie, you know, was posing for a lingerie catalog and was a bit player on a soap opera and was struggling to get modeling gigs. That's not a supermodel. And of course, when Byrne took over Spider-Man, he immediately made her a supermodel because I don't like that she's a supermodel. But I like this Next Men run, even though once again, he left mid-story, although this time it's because sales had dropped to the point where he could make more money drawing for DC than he could drawing his own stuff. He has since gone back and finished the run. But I want to sit down and read it because as much as Byrne irritates me, he has the capacity to tell great stories. His run on the Fantastic Four was phenomenal. His X-Men stuff, off the charts good. I even liked his run on Namor, and Namor's not a character I care for. And I remember liking the early issues of Next Men, but it came when there was just this unbelievable wave of comics. And it was hard to keep up on stuff, so I kind of... Well, I haven't read the last 2 issues, so I'm just going to drop it. And Byrne's a jerk. So they've reprinted the series in these 2 big trade paperbacks. Black and white, of course. But I got to be honest, I love that format. I love being able to go and pick up for $25, here's 20 issues of a book. Oh, but it's on crappy paper and black and white. I don't care, I just want to read it. Just want to read it. So, that's my comic list, and believe it or not, it's lasted over an hour. Here's the stuff that's upcoming. I do have a couple of interviews that I've emailed people, and they said they want to interview as soon as our schedules fit. I think they're really interesting people. I think they'll be good interviews. Neither one of them work in comics. I've said for, gosh, almost a year now that I'm going to do a special solo podcast on Jack Kirby. I've decided that that's what is going to be going here. So I'm going to do a podcast on Jack Kirby. I don't know how long it will be. I don't want to go more than, well, this episode's gone more than an hour, but most episodes are probably going to be around an hour because it's just me talking. And I don't want to listen to me for more than an hour. I doubt anybody else does. But I'm going to do Kirby. That may be one episode. It may be 10. I don't know. And then I've got a big project that's going to be starting. I'm going to do Solitaire Rose Histories. And the reason I call them Solitaire Rose Histories or Personal Histories is this is the stuff that I know and I've read and I've heard. And if there's something wrong, I want somebody to tell me. Because if I've got something wrong, I love being corrected because then I get to learn new things. So I'm going to be doing the Solitaire Rose History of EC Comics. I've actually lined up a couple of guests when I talk about it, but here's the format. Kind of get you excited, prime the pump a little bit. I'm going to get into the history of where EC Comics came from and how they came to be. You know, how did Educational Comics, which published stuff like picture stories from the Bible in the 40s, turn into the company that published Tales from the Crypt, Mad, Weird Science, Frontline Combat in the 50s, and is still thought of as the best comic book line ever printed? So I'm going to do an episode that gives that history. And then I'm going to do an episode on each series. I'm going to do one episode on Tales from the Crypt. Talk about the artists that worked on it, the stories that were in it, what the good and the bad of it was. Going to do one on crime suspense stories. Going to do one on Mad as a comic book. And I see that one as a huge project. I'm also looking for what you want to know. Email me at corey.strode@gmail.com if there's some part of comics history or something you would like me to discuss. I'm fascinated by comic book sales, and through the internet I've been able to get really accurate records that go back into the 60s. So one of the things I want to do as well is go into the rise of Marvel sales-wise. What are the myths about comic book sales? When you get into the 70s, I've read a lot about how sales reports in the 70s were really messy and how books that were sold well, the creators on them were told that they didn't sell well. How there were books that were canceled and they got the sales reports and, oh my gosh, this book is selling great, we gotta start it again. Or books that now, the Neil Adams, Denny O'Neill, Green Lantern, Green Arrow. DC has reprinted that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 separate times in 5 separate formats, starting with paperback books in the 70s. They've probably made a fortune off that run, but at the time it sold really poorly and was canceled. Why? Sales reports. So there's a whole lot I'm going to be doing with Solitaire Rose Radio. This episode went longer than I thought it would, which, if you listen to Crazy Comics and Stories, you should be used to by now. Thanks for stopping by. Thanks for listening. And remember, everybody's got stories.